This meeting is being live streamed. Hi, everyone. I'm Tobias Carlyle. This is Value After Hours. I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Jake Taylor. Very special guests today, Vinny Daniel and Porter Collins. The Seawolf boys are back. How are you, gents?
How you doing, guys? Doing
We're
well.
great. Passionate as ever, angry as ever, so we're ready to go.
That's what I want to hear.
Let's just wind them up and get out of the way.
Yeah.
How do you reconcile the Fed balance sheet shrinking, monetary base expanding, stocks up? What's going on? Way too confusing.
So, over the past few years, and first off, thanks for having us on. We love doing this and look forward to it. Anytime we could talk value names and spice in a little bit macro, we're always happy to do so.
Perfect.
And anyone who'll listen to us, which is great.
Yeah.
It's not many these days, but anyway, over the past few years, I began to subscribe to the views of Mike Howell from Cross Border Capital. Do you guys, and I'm giving him a free promotion on this one. And he does an incredible job of measuring liquidity, right? And most of the historic economist strategists look at liquidity and just look at bank balance sheets, like you said, reserves, QT, and the like. He goes one step further and he essentially includes into his equation the shadow capital markets liquidity, right? Which is all the non-bank capital that's at risk and at work. And as a result, and that measurement, right, which he does, I think he does a really good job. I never looked at the exact inputs. Volatility or the level of volatility is so important to the overall measurement of liquidity. And I'm going to try to keep this non-wonky, but if you're in a collateral-based system, which we are, highly levered, where you're financing yourself based upon collateral, the volatility of that collateral matters a lot. The lower the volatility, the higher the amount that you can lever. So let's look at the MOVE index and the VIX index over the past, say, year. They've been extremely low. So I believe the capital market system is so levered right now, abundant with liquidity, making bets upon bets on both sides of the equations, long and short. So when you look at liquidity that way, we're not tightening, we're actually expanding.
What goes into that private or into that kind of shadow banking system? Is that private credit, margin for hedge funds? I mean, what else goes in there?
It's private credit, margin for hedge funds. It also includes the financing of treasury securities and all things derivatives associated with it, such as the basis trade. And when you think about the way some of these guys make money, which is on a spread basis, the degree of leverage that they could have is a measurement of historic volatility with probably a 1 to 5 year look back. So as a result, I don't know if it's by design, but a bunch of us cynics believe that the Fed has caught on to this, to the fact that volatility can't go higher in order for this crazy system that they're running to work. And so far, they've been able to get away with it because volatility has been so low. So that's my long-winded answer. I apologize to you, Tobias, on why I think markets have gone up.
And Vinny's using all these fancy words now, but we're both Luddites, and we used to take field trips for a little lunch trip to the debt clock on 44th Street there in Times Square. And now they have it online, and you can see that the spending is outpacing the federal tax revenue by about $2 trillion.
Is that a lot?
And
every time I click on there, it's just mind-numbing to me. And so we're running a 7% budget deficit, and it's debt monetization. That's what's going on, right? And that's one of the reasons it scares me at the same time. And I don't know how to put my bear slash bull hat on that and think about it, but we've expressed that in a bullish theme for quite some time now. Sometimes better, some more right than others, but A, there's going to be more inflation for longer than you think there is. B, the you're just debasing assets against the dollar, right? And FX to FX, it's all trading fiat, but you can see what this gold move explodes from you know, 1960 to basically $2,400 here. And the move everyone's been waiting for, and in 6 weeks it explodes, right? Bitcoin's gone crazy. A lot of this stuff is happening, and I think it's waking people up again to the fact, oh, we do have a problem, right? I love Steve, our former boss, but you know, he's now a long only guy, and he's like, ah, don't worry about it, right? And listen, he'll worry about it when it's a problem, but and he's in stocks, and stocks are going up right now, right? And I think stocks are inflating against the dollar too. You can see that. Look at the PE multiple. For whatever reason, the PE multiples have exploded over the past 15 years. And so, you know, so I try to take, you know, the super bear hat on and find other ways to play it. You know, we do have shorts on, but you know, we're predominantly net long, right? And that's been the place to be. And listen, when that view changes, I'm going to change too. But you know, for now, that the both interest rates are pretty well contained, even though they've been moving higher. And so I see the debasement. And I choose not to short it. I choose to find other ways to play it.
If inflation is here to stay, and I think that that's the case, how do you play that from the long side?
Well, you know, a lot of the you know, if you covered retail ever, and you look at stocks and you take comps, for example, it's the same store comps, and a lot of it's just cycling the calendar, right? It was up 12% last year. Well, next year, you know, it's probably not going to be, it's probably gonna have a down comp, right? It's because it's hard to comp that 12% comp. And that's what happened with inflation, right? We ran so hot. Of course, you know, once you started to cycle the hard comps, you know, things changed, right? And so, or the easy comps, and now it's just coming back again, and it's just basically the turning of the calendar, and nothing's really changed, right? And from a, you know, debt monetization perspective, and the, you know, the velocity money is picking up again, and so, you know, the way we've played it, and we own, yes, we own value, we have some growth names too, but you know, we own everything in the periodic tables. Right. We own, you know, we own coal stocks, we own oil stocks, we own metals, we own uranium, you know, we own financials, you know, we own shipping names.
Element is that?
What's that?
So which element is the financials?
Well, you know,
Fugate, do you not know this one? It's called
Cool School.
F-U-G, Fugazi.
Yeah.
Fugazi.
Yeah, exactly. So, but we own a lot of this stuff, and you know, the problem with, we'll start with the gold miners, right? The gold miners have been horrible stocks for a long time, and it's a really hard business, right? Getting gold and silver out of the ground is very, very difficult, right? It's much harder than coal and oil and all this sort of stuff. It's hard to find, and there's a lot of inflationary costs. But you know, if you know, and a lot of bad jurisdictions, right? Look at what happened to in Panama this year. They took over the silver mine, right? And all of a sudden, your biggest asset's out of commission. And so we've chose to stuck with Aneco Mines, and that's sort of the Cadillac of the group. And it's never been cheap, but you know, you start plugging in, you know, we just, again, 3 weeks ago, we were at 1900 gold. You start plugging in 2400 gold where we are now, stock's not as expensive anymore, right? And there's a lot of operating levers that obviously that comes through when you plug in $500 higher gold prices. And so that's sort of what we've been waiting for, and it's been a horrible value trap for the past 2 or 3 years. But again, it hadn't really gone down all that much on us. And so, yes, it was painful to wait around, and some, you know, like a good value investor, We too deal with value traps, and the question is, how do you deal with them? Do you chuck them overboard, or do you wait? You know, wait for things to improve. You know, if you believe in the management team, if you believe in what's going on, it gives you a little bit more conviction to hang with them. And so that was one we hung with better, It's obviously done well for us. So
The other thing we try and look for, which is a little bit difficult when you have that sad thing called valuation in as part of your process, is anything that has pricing power, and is a function and has a moat around it. So to me, the crown jewel names that I know, or crown, four names that I know that have this, Visa, MasterCard, Moody's, and S&P, they're always listed as the names that people love and the like. But of course, when you go and look at the valuation, it was like, okay, it's in there. So I get it, and they can continue to grind higher, but they're a little bit too rich for my blood. However, you could start going down deeper names and then just trying to find names that actually do have moats that are not readily foreseen, right? One of the names that we've owned, still own, is the name AerCap, which happens to be the largest aircraft lessor in the business. And I wouldn't say they have tremendous pricing power, but they have enough of a control of what's going on in the business where they're always at play, and so they will get premium economics. And that is rarely ever reflected in the valuation of the name. So that's where we try to look for to say, okay, where are the moats? But and they're not as great as everyone as the ones we all know and love, but do have some pricing power.
do you find that you those hidden moats, are they do they tend to be more like the best business in a otherwise perceived to be crappy industry? Because I mean,
Yes.
air leasing, that's always everyone's always like, oh, don't go there, right?
Well, it's funny. We found, I wouldn't say it's called a moat, but yes, the answer is absolutely. And so as a result, you fight, we talk about this all the time, all of us, right? That our biggest risk is a value trap that we're sitting on something for 3 years and it does nothing. One of the names that we started looking at the cannabis industry, right? You talk about, I love when you start naming a name and you take your 100% investor TAM, and the minute you say a word, you're down to 20%. And then you say another word, you're down to 15, then to 5, then to 2, and there's your addressable investors that can invest in the names. So of the work that we started doing, the name that we realized that was the low-cost producer, and not that I think you would laugh at
I'm going
myself.
to throw out another a screen on this one. It was also a SPAC.
Correct. It was also a SPAC, right? And I would also say that sadly, or maybe greatly, Porter and I are not weed smokers. So this is coming from a completely ignorant lens, is Glass House, which is located in California. They have some of the best agriculture. Their lands are right near where we get strawberries and blueberries and the like. So they are the low-cost provider in California. If you guys are smoking dope in California, chances are you probably might have smoked some Glass House weed.
I think there's a lot of that going on in California.
Yes. And with the upcoming potential catalyst of federal legislation, the descheduling of the drug, and have God willing, some form of either federal or state by state interstate commerce, this stock can really take off. And the reason where the moat lies is their moat lies in the cost of producing this stuff, whereas a lot of others can't get that low.
And it sort of hit a lot of different touch points for us. A, we're always looking for growth stocks, and it's a growth stock, right?
Literally.
They have they're building out all these different greenhouses, and so the low cost producer can increase its supply by a lot. They're only 20% utilized right now, so they a lot of growth runway ahead of them. It was a value stock. It was hated. It was contrarian, and not many people can own it yet. And so, the question is we thought we could win without federal legalization, right? It's one of the few companies in the cannabis space that actually makes money. And so we can withstand a bear market. Actually, from a fundamental perspective, it's probably better in the near term if everyone else goes out of business, and they're not going out of business at all. So, the capital structure is a little fugazi, and it's a SPAC, and it has a lot of crap attached to it. But, we try to look for these kind of off the beaten path, value, weird, contrarian names. And that was one of them we came across.
Yeah,
There's a
imagine
chunk.
what the business could do if they could actually get a bank account.
Yeah.
Or get listed on the New York Exchange. I mean, or issue securities. Yeah,
And the
I
big
mean,
upside is if they do interstate commerce, where you can sell weed not in California, but in New York, which or any of these northern states where the cost to produce is just so much higher. And so you know, it's a huge upside. So again, a stock that we thought when we underwrote it had, you know, 10 times upside and not a lot of downside. And so, you know, we do have a bunch of those special situations in our portfolio, and some of them can be value traps for a little while and sometimes not. And we were talking earlier about, obviously, you know, you guys do a lot of screening, value screening. The other screening we've been doing a lot more of is insider buys. And it's a really interesting thing, and it really makes you think when you go through some of these names. And you know, one of the names in we own in the portfolio, CEO bought $115 million of stock personally. Wasn't granted to him. He paid that in cash, right? And so you start thinking about like, wow, that's a big number, right? And you know, we screen from anywhere from, you know, $500,000 and up. And you know, Aon is a name that we don't own, but you know, CEO, 65-year-old, 65-year-old chairman of the board buys $16 million of stock. And you sit there going, what the hell's going on here? And so another thing that makes you think, and you know, you put it through another screen again, is it cheap? What does it look like? And you know, we own three stocks in that screen, right? And then you go to do a shameless plug here. I learned some screens in this book, which
What a
is the
great book. What a
Acquirer's
great cover.
Multiple book.
I also noticed, Tobias,
The author.
you were rocking a mug of the Acquirer's Multiple that, you
Yeah, I
know.
have a mug. I do have a
I
mug.
really do like that.
Where's my mug? It's not
How
showing
the
off.
billionaire contrarians of deep value beat the market. Vin and I are not billionaires, but I can still use the book.
You can't. Me either.
So, you know, you go through that screen, and we own 10 of those names. Right? It's a lot. It's a lot. And they're all controversial, right? They're there for a reason. You know, what the biggest market cap on there is obviously is Baba. And you know, I think it's over the last month and a half, the FXI has outperformed the S&P and NASDAQ. Right? Kind of interesting, right? And so, you know, as a true contrarian, you know, you got to kind of go through the thing. What, you know, what can go right? Right? Is there a manufacturing reacceleration in China and reacceleration in the U.S.? You know, I think the manufacturing PMIs in the U.S. were below 50 for 18 months, Vinny, something like that. You know, that's a long time. And so you're finally starting to see, for whatever reason, a reacceleration. So maybe, you know, this is Chinese tech, but the Chinese market can do better under that scenario, right? So, you know, and we also did a screen prior to this podcast of looking for an emerging markets stocks in that acquires multiple. Obviously, the list is bigger than the U.S. one because there's just a lot more value overseas, and obviously, emerging markets has much more risk, but you know, you buy oil companies in Brazil or Colombia or you know, wherever, not much operational risk, much more operational risk than there is ExxonMobil, right? And so a big stock that we own still is Petrobras. It's got some hair around it with Lula and the CEO and whether you're gonna really get the dividends. But the stock doubled last year, and it went from, I think, 1.7 times EV/EBITDA to, I think now it's, you know, two and a half, right? Whereas ExxonMobil is, I think, or I think Chevron, I forget, I think the number is wrong, but, you know, they make as much as Chevron does, but the market cap's like 25% of Chevron's.
They looked like they were planning to. I remember looking at it 18 months or so ago, and I think it was $9. And there was over the next 18 months, they were paying out $12 in dividends or something like that. Did that end up?
Yeah,
Did
they
that happen? Did they make those payments?
we got 25% of div we got a 25% dividend yield last year.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, Ecopetrol's in Colombia, it's a 20-something percent dividend yielder, right? because it's in Colombia. And if you look at the Colombian currency recently, it's appreciated a lot. Colombian banks have done much better recently. And so you sort of, you know, being a financials guy, you have to deal with every possible risk out there. So, and we've done emerging markets before. So you look at the currencies, you look at the banks, how are all this stuff doing? That's the another screen you do of like, hey, can I buy this if banks are imploding in Colombia? The answer is no. Right. And so, so we go through all these things and just try to figure out, you know, we try to look for the easy trades, not the hard trades.
Within value. The easy trade would have been buy NVIDIA and call it a day. Right.
But so. that wasn't our expertise. I don't know shit about semiconductors. So that's a problem.
Quite true.
That didn't stop a lot of other people go from up. Making
I don't think it stopped. I mean, it doesn't stop any of my friends who call me up and say, what should I do with it? Of course, I got that call today. It's like, what should I do with NVIDIA? And I told them, look, you should sell half, right?
Yeah.
Sell half. Because let's get into human emotion. If you don't sell and the stock's down 25%, the next thing you're going to say is, well, I'll sell when it gets back up to par for you or whatever the high note was. And then chances are and I'm not saying we are, but if we were in a bear market or a deep bear market, there's another 50% to go. And then you're never going to sell. And that's how you become a bag holder. So selling those crazy names that go like that and selling half and half and half again gets you to keep your profits.
Now, you know, let's discuss our own philosophy here on gold, right? Gold is talked about how gold went from 1900 to 2400 here or whatever it is. And everyone I talk to has sold or trimmed or sold. I don't think there's a lot of people that I talk to that are actively buying right here because, you know, the RSIs are high. The PTSD in gold has been horrendous. You know, I don't know. We trimmed some names, but it's very small. And I just think I'm going to sometimes just sitting on your hands, waiting, seeing, you know, we're in no rush to, you know, we have no outside investors. So we have no rush to, you know, hit the sell button. We try to, you know, sell everything for long-term cap gains. So that's an issue too. So, you know, I'm sitting waiting around and again, you look at the debt problem. Is it going to get better in your lifetime, Tobias?
Unlikely. I don't see how. I mean, why would it? There's no reason to.
Jake, will the debt problem get better in your lifetime?
That's a really good question because you then think about a lot of other permutations like Jubilees and
see, Jake, I'm in your camp that it will get better over my lifetime. It will not get better over the next 3 to 5 years, right? Or
how long are you guys planning to live?
It will get better when the bond market tells them it needs to get better, right? And so far
they got to wake up Nancy Pelosi, Joe Biden, and you know, every other politician that's 80 years old that doesn't really give a shit.
Well, the running joke of the meme today was when Janet Yellen was drinking the beer with I forgot who else she was with. I think she was in China. And I forgot who said it. It was like, by the time I'm done drinking this beer, I would have printed 4 million or I forgot it was 40 million of paper, right? And that's the problem. They just can't stop.
I think they print $5 billion or deficit grows by $5 billion a day.
It's insanity.
Jeez.
It's a lot. It's just a problem, right? And the problem, as it gets bigger, the interest payments accelerate.
So, and for us, as Porter said, like, I don't want all of us to slit our wrists and our throats, particularly as market participants.
We try to do that all the time, but.
No, but we've come to learn that the way to express yourself is not by being uber bearish in terms of capital markets because of the debasement effects. So we try and go and find, like you guys said, where do you look? If that's your viewpoint, and it is, where do you look for opportunities? And we look for anything that really can't be printed. If I had to keep a simple elevator pitch, is we look for things that can't be printed and where supply is deficient. And then from there, we start doing our work as what's better than others.
we're great cash flowing businesses, right?
Yes.
You know, we don't own a lot of zero, you know, not, you know, non-revenue companies. We have a couple of moonshot, you know, medical device company that could possibly pass the FDA or something like that, you know, or, you know, factory opens, things work, and, you know, so we have a couple of those, but the rest of our portfolio is cash flowing entities, right?
So a basket of commodities is beating the S&P 500 this year. I saw that on Twitter.
Yeah.
You know, go take a look at the platinum chart.
I was funny. Me and you were, and I was going to mention platinum. Just so you go at it.
No, it's just it's like the contrarian's dream. It's gotten killed. And Vince pointed out that the platinum card ranks higher in the Amex ecosystem than gold, and the two have crisscrossed in the night in terms of prices. And so I don't know. It's and so there's a couple of ways to play it. You know, Anglo American, a bunch of other, you know, Sibanye-Stillwater. There's degenerate ways to play it, and there's cash flowing ways to play it. So or you can just play the commodity.
The beauty of platinum, and it's how long have we been doing this? 25 minutes. We haven't spoken about Tesla yet, but here we go. The beauty of platinum, and it's not really a Tesla thing. It's actually not a Tesla thing. It's an EV thing. That, you know, when people dream of the TAM of EV by 2040 and the like, might come to fruition. Who the hell knows? Their spreadsheet will do wonders. Ours won't. But at least in the near-term portion of that ramp from now to 2040, it's not looking so good for EV. And I'm not even talking, yes, Tesla, their sales are down and the like. But
what
I'm
about
talking
the robo-taxis, Vinny?
I'm talking, stop. I'm talking about Mercedes. I'm talking about BMW. I'm talking about Ford, GM. All of them are doing a pivot. And Toyota seems like they had it right from the jump to say, not so fast. These hybrids are probably the better technology for now until we really figure this out. And so what that means, long-winded way for platinum, is that if catalytic converters, which everyone thought they would make zero catalytic converters by 2030, all of a sudden we're making more than zero, platinum is in demand, right? And then when you take that into account, that fundamental view, and marry it with the chart that you're looking at with platinum, which is on its ass, there is an opportunity.
During the UConn basketball game last night, Ford had a commercial out. You know, you think of the Super Bowl 2 years ago, it was all electric. Last night, the commercial was, we have it all. We have gas, we have electric, and we have, you know, hybrids. So it's interesting, right?
The weird thing about those hybrids is how hard they are to buy, because I've just bought a car. I just rolled one of my cars, and I wanted the hybrid for exactly that reason, that you can get these like 30-mile EV that converts into a ICE, which is perfect because I drive around a little area where I am, want to drive longer periods. They're not available anyway. They don't exist. They're not real cars.
The big miss of Seawolf about a year or two ago was truly not believing in what you believed in, which is that hybrids were going to be an answer. I wouldn't say the answer, but an answer. And, you know, I was going around, shopping around, looking for a hybrid. And it's like, why wouldn't I buy this over an EV? And I think Toyota was trading, you would talk about an acquirer's multiple valuation. Toyota, which is once again turning out to be the best auto manufacturer in the world, I think was trading at sub 5x. Some crazy number for such a quality franchise. And it just sat there because everyone thought they were dead. It's not the case anymore. So yeah, I'm with you, Tobias. Like it's, I actually think you had to be a complete contrarian and ignore everything you've heard from your friends, to TV, social media, to everything else. Say, no, I don't think this is going to work as well as you people think.
You mean you had to think for yourself?
Yes, something like that.
I'm actually on the wait list for the Toyota Land Cruiser hybrid. I'm pretty excited. I get it in 2035, but other than that, it'll be great.
The other problem is that it's like buying, it's as expensive as buying two cars, that they were, you know, there's such a huge premium on
they're
the
not
hybrid.
They're not expensive anymore, though.
Well, I was looking at the Lexus. They had a GX and a TX. And
oh, yeah. The Diddy's are expensive, but you can get a cheaper hybrid. I was looking at the Lexus as well, which is a really nice car. It is.
Yeah.
I'm a true value guy. I'm too cheap. I'm usually a used car guy, but this might be my first new car in quite some time.
Well, do you know what I did? Do you know how I solved the problem? There's this little car company, you might not have heard of it, Tesla. They make these EVs. They had this deal on where you could get, it was 2.5 down. It was like 250 a month or something. So I was like, all right, I'll do it. Let's do it.
Good
So
job.
I'm
No,
now driving a Tesla.
at least you got him cheap, which is good. You hurt his margins.
Well, it's a nice car. I mean, this
Yeah.
stock could do really well. The car's really nice.
I mean, go to
Have you heard of this guy,
Hertz.
Musk?
Have you driven one? That's finally the
Oh,
answer is
that's the
yes.
classic. That's the classic bull line. Have you driven one?
It is a nice drive. I mean, I got to say, I did say this. I don't think when I got into it, it actually made me a little bit angry that the other car manufacturers, like, there's just stuff in there that just it makes sense. I don't know why the other car guys don't do it. So I go from my Toyota to my Tesla. One's like driving a boat.
You like driving cars without suspension? They're great.
Yeah, I drive around my little area. It's very smooth. It's too easy. Yeah, I agree. They're stiff. Energy, fellas. Segue into energy. What do you think? Where are we?
Well, we've never subscribed to the, explosion in energy prices. When you buy these stocks, you have to underwrite these things to $60 to $80, West Texas Brent prices, whatever. And we bought these things under those scenarios, and now we're looking at $85 West Texas and $90 Brent prices. And we own a lot of emerging market oil companies. I mean, too many. Between Petrobras, Ecopetrol, a couple other Colombian names, Occidental, we still own. And these emerging market stocks are still under, call it, everything's under, definitely under 3x EV/EBITDA, and some of these Colombian stocks that we own are under 2x, and pumping out huge dividends, buying back stock, tenders, everything. And so you just gotta look a little harder, and that's kind of, I mean, we can. So that's where we are.
That's just to add on to that. I think when looking at energy now, when we started investing in energy, say in 22, it was like shooting fish in a barrel, right? Because everything was grotesquely cheap, out of favor, like everything we all love. Now that's not the case anymore. So it's funny. I just rolled up a chart of ExxonMobil or Diamondback or FANG, and I can't go out and suggest to people you need to be owning this right now. I mean, the next 5, 10% in the name, or even 15%, is a 50% probability it's up or down. So I
We
think
actually sold our Diamondback recently.
we did. And so on the other hand, as Porter was saying, I think you need to look at different markets, different sectors within the energy space to find where there are pockets of opportunity. So in the mega cap energy space, I see no opportunities there whatsoever. I have nothing bad against them. As Porter said, the prices of energy justify where the stock prices are. But on the other hand, we find names that have, because of PTSD of their own kind, they have zero debt on their balance sheet. I mean, not net debt, like zero debt on their balance sheet, because they just don't trust capital markets will give them the benefit of the doubt. And because they're not part of an ETF and not joining in on the parade and the party, they trade at crazy low multiples, and the most important, they take the excess cash flows, or at least a portion of them, and buy back stock at 2 to 3x. So we are seeing share counts
Singing my
drop
song.
by 8 to 12% per annum. On the other hand, I see you guys own, and we own it as well. It's not the greatest part of the calendar year for met coal right now. You own Warrior Met Coal. Warrior Met Coal is in the opposite approach. Is they're CapExing a new mine that, once it comes into fruition in 26 and 27, and assuming met prices stay roughly where they are, slightly higher, or at the sort of the lower end of the seasonal spot right now, the cash flows just gush. And you're talking about a stock that, again, is trading at between probably 2.5 to 5x EBITDA, depending on the price. Those are the things we're looking at, but you can no longer just, I wouldn't blindly go out and buy the XLE right now, because it's run up so much this year.
But let's go back to the acquirers multiple list of stuff that shows up in the screen. Number two on the list in terms of market cap, BP, that's on there. Petrobras, Eco Patrol, which we own, is we've owned for over 2 years now. And then there was a M&A, I don't want to produce it wrong, pronounce it wrong, but Chord or Chord Energy, CHRD, that they did an acquisition that's on the list too. That's in the XOP. So, you know, there are names out there. You just got to kind of pull around and look. And, you know, we actually, when that M&A came out, we looked at this thing. We're like, I've never even heard it before. So we took a look. It was cheap and they were buying another cheap stock. I, you know, I can't speak for the reserves and all that kind of stuff, but it looked really interesting. So there is a lot of stuff to do. You just got to poke around and do your research and,
you know, think out of the box. So in general, would you guys, do you guys in your entire careers, as far as opportunity sets go today, how do you feel like this ranks?
We're not jumping up and down at stuff. I mean, we've had a good year so far this year. Thankfully, some of our shorts have worked too. But it's been a, it's, you know, Ben and I would be happy if we closed the books right now. So, but
sell in April and go away.
Yeah, sell in April and go away. But, you know, I think that I have no reason to sell these companies right now. Right. I actually think that if Petrobras clears a lot of this noise with regard to the extra dividends and the CEO, the stock could be on a big move after that. You know, the question is, you know, do you buy it after that? You can easily buy it after that news. So, yeah.
We are finding idiosyncratic. I agree. I was thinking scale of 1 to 10. I would say we're probably at a 5 or a 6 right now. Mm. We are finding idiosyncratic opportunities, but one-offs. It's just interesting stuff that, because they're probably small cap or micro cap or and the like, they seem they're very compelling, or there's a certain binary outcome to them that it's down 30% if we're wrong, 2 to 3 bagger if we're right. And you got to put a certain amount of capital towards that. You can't bet the farm, but those are nice things to have in the portfolio. So that's why I'm saying there are opportunities, but in terms of where life's easy and you could own just the fundamental thing you like and everything's cheap, no, that doesn't really exist right now.
You know, we'll talk about another stock that was on the acquirers multiple list was Geo, right? The prison REIT, right? And we wrote it up on our annual letter, and we wrote all these sectors, you know, these stocks, blah 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 blah, prisons, and like people immediately like, ah, these guys are idiots, like they're nuts. And you know, like, yes, it was a prison story, and more funding from the government and all that kind of stuff, but they had a debt stack that was, you know, refiable, right? And once they got, you know, it was still cash flowing like crazy. Once they got the, you know, the cash in the door, they had a huge debt stack to refi, and the stock is absolutely ripped. And so, you know, there's plenty of stories out there still, and the market is very inefficient, right? There's a lot of names to buy, right? And the stock that I was talking about, where the CEO bought a $115 million of stock, is called Sable Offshore, SOC. And I don't know, you know, it probably is a value trap, but if they get the approvals, the stock can go to 20 or 30 bucks, right? And that's 2 to 3 times your money. And so, you know, there's opportunity like that where you can take shots on goal. And listen, we can take a bunch of those shots on goal and not have it kill us if we're wrong. But, you know, I think you have to, there's room in the portfolio to take a couple of these educated shots where, you know, you don't know inside information at all, but you see what the CEO knows, or you see what the CEO does. And, you know, he must have pretty good information. He's going to put $115 million of his own money up. So that's the type of stuff that's like, I don't know, it looks pretty interesting to me. Right. And it's priced off of Brent, which is now 90 bucks. So, you know, the price target's probably even higher from here. So
what about the smalls? Do you ever dig through the smalls, see anything interesting in there? Because that's where I think at the moment I can find operating businesses in there that seem pretty good value, pretty good businesses, pretty good valuations. And I think I said that, but pretty good business, pretty good valuations.
Tobias, when you say the small caps, you're saying? Or?
Yeah, small. Like, I think, you know, Diamond Hill, Value Line, Big Larry, those kind of names are all pretty interesting.
We don't own a lot of those things. I mean, the funny thing is we've been buying some small cap financials recently. You know, the markets are just kind of inefficient, right? You know, we had this opportunity. Robinhood came out and they offered a 3% cashback card, and you know, as a good value investors, Vinny and I are cashback card holders, and so we go, holy crap, 3% cashback, let's do it. And so we signed up for the Robinhood card, and which all everyone should, and we said, well, crap, who's doing this card? And we found this little bank called CCB, Coastal Community Bank, and you know, they're taking most of the operational risk but not taking the credit risk, which, you know, Robinhood will blow up on the credit card, but that's 3 or 4 years down the road. And you know, they also got they won the Walmart contract recently too, so they're about to be the card behind Walmart. And so I'm sitting there looking at the stock that's, you know, it's average value for a bank, but they have two massive catalysts ahead of it. And so, and no one cares. No one's looking, you know, every, like, kind of the bank investors, you know, we talk to, like, there's risk. There's this, there's operational. Oh, these are rent-a banks, and the regulators hate the rent-a banks. I got that, you know, and, you know, do your due diligence, but, you know, like, there are small cap names. Listen, you know better than anyone. Small caps are very inefficient because there's not many eyes looking at it. You know, everyone's doing, you know, ETFs, and the active managers are all in large cap stock. So there's not many, there's a lot of orphans in small cap.
Why would Walmart partner with someone as small as CCB?
Tobias, great question. This specific product is a deposit product that Walmart is trying to roll out. So this gets into some of the nuances of financial services and this arbitrage that exists under the Durbin Act. If you're a bank that's under $10 billion of assets, any card you issue under your bank, under your bank name, a debit card, you get to charge premium economics as if it's a credit card. So Walmart, if you're issuing a debit card and you want to garner premium economics on anything that people use on their debit card, you can't go out and choose
Citi,
JP Morgan, whatever. You have to go to a small bank. And there's these things called, we used to call them rent-a-banks, but the fintech people astutely realized that calling something a rent-a-bank is a low multiple business. So they turned it into BaaS, bank as a service. I can't say I necessarily love a lot of the operating practices of these BaaS players, but in general, I don't make the rules. They don't allow me to, for better or worse, probably for better. And as a result, it is what it is. And these things are allowed to do what they do. And they got the Walmart contract. That's the reason why Walmart would choose them over, say, a JP Morgan or a Wells Fargo or Bank of America or you name them.
What's the policy reason for doing that? Keep them in business?
Going back, way back when, the community banks, which were a very powerful lobby to keep the premium economics. So your local community banks and probably your credit unions were correctly said, this is a big part of our business. Don't take it away. Of course, the grifters came in and made a business out of it, right? Should they change the law? Yes, they should. Will they change the law? Probably. 95% chance the answer is no.
Do you guys agree with
the funny thing is all these fintech companies, you know, think Square, PayPal, they're all using the rails of these smaller banks. And then to stay under the $10 billion cap, they take them and farm them out to disperse these things all over the place. And so it's a nice little niche business model.
And these small banks, I can't believe I'm giving the bear case while I'm bullish on one of them. these small banks, if they ever get deposits in excess or assets in excess of $10 billion, they sweep the deposits off their balance sheet to people who need deposits for a fee. CFPB, you should listen to this, and it would be properly regulated, but I know you're not, so I could shout through the rooftops that you should be doing this, and they won't. Not even just CFPB, but Congress. But yeah, it's a small little cottage industry within the financial services industry that if you're one of the clowns that play in the FIG sandbox like we have our entire career, you know the rules of engagement.
But again, it's kind of what we do is, you know, you find a value name and you start saying, hey, what could go right? Right. We have this stock. It's still our biggest holding, not the best company in the world, but it's called BGC. Right. And it's an interdealer broker. It was sitting there, you know, left for dead at $5. Stock hadn't done anything for 14 years. And, you know, has anything changed? And we thought the business had finally inflected and things changed. Another stock I'll bring up that it may or may not be in the acquirer's multiple list is Virtu Financial, right? I believe that's in the Zig. And same thing, right? It's sat there, hadn't done much. But lo and behold, when all these Bitcoin ETFs started up, right? BlackRock doesn't hold they're in a trust. So when subscriptions and redemptions come in, Virtu and Citadel, all these guys are the facilitators of these trades. And because there's so many different exchanges in crypto land, there's a lot of ability to arb the different price spreads. And so they've been making huge profits. You just read the transcript in the 4Q transcript, they talk about it. And so, you know, you can see where Virtu stock finally inflected, right? Sitting there, cheap stock, what could go right? And that's an example of what could go right. And so, you know, we do a lot of that, you know, what could go right on a cheap stock, and get back to the insider buying. Hey, why is this guy buying stock? What's going on? Why did an insider of Dr. Pepper just buy $17 million of stock? Again, not a stock we own, but I asked the question myself, what the heck's going on here?
Do you guys agree with Buffett's recent, in his letter, he said that he thought today's markets were more speculative than they were when he was younger, which is quite a statement, I think. He sort of tucked it in there, but...
In ways. I believe that the entire system is more levered and geared, right? And as a result,
one could call that irresponsible.
Correct. And as a result, probably more speculative in ways that maybe people don't think about. However, I think that like 2020, every generation has a moment where they get rinsed, right? Like, you know, for my generation, it was the tech burst, right? And others, it was 87, and where the markets teach you not to be too euphoric.
For me, it was 73, 74.
to me, 2022 was supposed to be that moment for this younger generation, and the powers that be blinked. And I think it's an interesting discussion of why, but the blink they did. And as a result, we now have just as much speculation as we had, maybe not as much during the COVID era, but the speculation, that fever is still there to buy really stupid shit too.
Listen, I'll go back to the bigger irresponsibility is the fact that Congress is running a 7.5% budget deficit during full employment. Like, you know, where are the adults in the room? Where are they? You got Vinny and I screaming, and no one gives a shit about Vinny and I. That's for sure. And there's about seven other people that are jumping up and down, and everyone thinks we're nuts, right? So that's where I think that the problem is, and goes back to what I said. Like, will this problem get better? I just don't see it. I don't see how it can mathematically at this point. We're you know, 125% debt to GDP. It's not a great place.
And let's not forget, there's an election to win. Right. So at the very least, over the next 3 to 6 months, look, I'm more bearish on our fiscal situation than 3 to 6 months. But at least for the next 3 to 6 months, the last thing you will ever hear from Biden's mouth is we need to tighten our belt, or at least believe anything that comes out of his mouth of tightening the belt. It's just not going to happen.
And we're we've been wrong, and every time the Fed's been painted into a corner, they've escaped, right? The bond market went to 5% in October. Every stock was, on the lows, and Yellen, flipped the bill and coupon issuance, and voila, stock market rips, bond market, drops 125 bips, and so. Not to say that we can't get out of this. The conditions for, the where we are aren't great.
It's a funny macro backdrop where you have the Fed trying tightening or staying pretty tight, but also saying where we plan to cut six times in 2024, three times in 2024. Next time we meet, we're cutting. So they're keeping everybody's waiting for the cut, which means asset price is probably going to levitate. At the same time, the fiscal side is priming the pumps as hard as they can, like debt jubilee and. Or not a jubilee, but like student debt
Yeah,
forgiveness.
debt orgy, I think, is what you're looking for. Well,
Massive.
if you think about it through our lens, right, where debt is unsustainable and you can't, like, if you try to run fiscally prudent, you can try, but the S&P is probably going to drop 30 to 50%, right? And with massive unemployment and the like. So once you look at the macro and fiscal policies through that lens, everything they do starts to make sense. So like a few weeks ago, I can't believe, well, no, I can't believe they did this 1 year after SVB. They put out some, I forgot what it is, rules or proposal or advice to the FDIC to relax this wonky rule called SLR in the banking industry, which would allow them to base for banks to buy treasuries without it being included in the calculation of risk weights. Now, the reason why they want to do that is because we need somebody to buy our debt. And banks are constrained by the capital rules of which they have to adhere to. However, if they're strained by the capital rules, why don't we change the capital rules? Now, we always thought that this was going to be the preferred option that they were going to initially choose, because the banks are the best people to buy treasury debt because the executives are compensated off of assets so they can get fat rich buying treasuries with deposit capital, right? However, with SVB, I thought that, well, now I can't do it. I mean, look what happened to SVB and First Republic and all that. SVB blew up because they had a duration mismatch liability of excess securities, right? Now, Vinny, they need to do it, and so they're going to go back and do it again, right? And they have to, because someone has to buy the debt. Sucks, but you kind of know when you feel the way we feel, a lot of the moves they make are very easy to see. You don't start questioning what they're doing. You just know what they're trying to solve for.
I mean, the Fed has that ostensible mandate, which is stable money supply, full employment. We've got the full employment.
Yeah.
Stock market's at all-time highs.
Yeah.
That wasn't one of the mandates.
Let's get, I mean, I think it's funny you look at the Fed balance sheet. It has been continuously kind of ticking down since it peaked a few years ago. It spiked when Silicon Valley Bank went nuts, but it's now below that. But at the same time, this the monetary base just inflected maybe October 22, something like that.
And
It's
that was not surprise, not a coincidence. That was the time when the yen blew out initially.
yeah.
And more importantly, the UK pension system was close to tapioca and they were about to suffer a margin call. So that was their moment where it was not a whatever it takes to get inflation down. It was whatever it takes to get inflation down until something breaks and then I have to change the rules, right? And go into an easing cycle.
Now we have a CPI print coming out tomorrow, and Vin and I are great conspiracy theorists, and they're in there. The BLS is in there doctoring up numbers, or the Fed, whoever does the number. They're doctoring numbers to, you know, to make it so it's not inflationary. You know, one of the things someone wrote about recently was the doctoring of the EIA oil numbers. They have this production number, and then they have this adjustment factor. And you know, for 10 years, the adjustment factor is flat. And then in the last like 6 months, it just hockey sticks up higher. So the adjustment factor is, oh, we just produced all this oil in the shale patch. And sure enough, it was an adjustment factor, right? So, you know, never, you know, trying to short the government is like trying to short Elon. You know, they come up with these miraculous saves, you know, when they're on death's door. So that's a warning to all you short sellers out there.
I have a question for you guys. But first, this morning, just as a running joke, because Friday after the close, Elon pulled one of his, you know, great narrative shifts of FSD in a definitive time date. We were playing for about 10, 15 minutes, and it became a bit addictive and intoxicating. Porter sent me a YouTube of the Wile E. Coyote and the Roadrunner. And just saying, I go, well, we know who the Roadrunner is, Musk, and we're the Wile E. Coyote. And every time you think you got him, he just goes beep, beep, and he just blows you out. And like you just can't really catch him at all. It was a good 15-minute laugh, knowing that you were probably going to get squeezed today again because of this, you know, robo-taxi narrative. I've noticed some of the recently, it's not where we typically play, but some of the consumer discretionary names like Starbucks, Nike, and the like have really come in. McDonald's, and they're not discretionary, but have really come in hard. Have you guys started looking at them or thinking about them?
You know, there's a few things in the screen. I see Fizz, just LaCroix, and a few other things that I have seen it, but I wonder if there's a bigger.
My guess is that's China related. Like both Nike and Starbucks, a big component of their future growth expansion plans are China related. And so if you start to chop that terminal value out, you can bring the price in a fair amount.
They tell me Lululemon tight pants are out of style. I don't know. I'll take the over on that.
Well, there's half my there's half my closet finished. There's, I think, yeah, someone mentioned Hershey as well. A few things have come in.
Yeah.
I think a lot of that is direct to consumer. Like that, a lot of stuff that was, you had to advertise and then you had to get it in. I mean, and Keurig, Dr. Pepper might be another one.
But look at Hershey. Stocks come in, but it's still 20 times earnings. And, you know, as we know, talk about, Jake was asking us about inflation. Hershey or cocoa prices. It's like it looks better than NVIDIA, right? So their input prices have just like quadrupled and the stock's still 20 times estimates, right? So, you know, there's a big, as we've talked about a lot, there's a big gap between where ETFs, growth people buy stocks and where real people buy stocks. Right. And cheap valuations. So
where did you get to on Keurig Dr. Pepper?
I haven't done the work yet, honestly, but I was intrigued.
In those big ships, when those guys make those big buys like that, is it enough to sort of move the stock?
No.
One of our best friends, made his fortune with the K cup originally, which went from like 30 cents in the
long or short
the Green Mountain coffee for 36 bucks. Shout out to John Grimley.
That was a big short of Einhorn's too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was very anti Green Mountain for a long time there. Cause when the patent rolled off and you could get anybody could make the cups. I think that was his big thesis. I think it's still doing okay.
Dr. Pepper's 12 times EBITDA. Not expensive, but you know, maybe something is inflected. I don't know. So,
fellas, we are going to be running out of time here a little bit. It's always fun having you on. If folks want to follow along with you or get in contact, what's the best way of doing that?
Twitter's the easiest place to find us. A lot of people ask questions and like to mess around single stock ideas. So you can find us at I'm at Seawolf Cap.
And I'm at VD718, and we're on Twitter, refuse to call it X. Yeah, just send us. I think my DMs are closed, but if you send me something and it's intriguing, I always email you back. I try because I don't like talking single stocks on a broad spectrum like that, but I don't mind doing it, or at least what I think is
DMs.
in DMs, which I think are at least less to the broader public.
And except for Tesla, we don't talk about shorts.
True. Try not to.
Thanks very much, gents.
All
Vinny
righty.
Daniel, Porter Collins, Seawolf Cap, and Jake Taylor.
Appreciate it,
We'll be
guys.
back next week.
Thank
See you in
you.
fix.